Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for calling into this very special roundtable discussion with Madeline Ballard as our guest, discussing this new report put out, The Practitioner Expertise to Optimize Community Health Systems, Harnessing Operational Insight. So what we're going to be exploring today is this question around gaps. There's a lot of gaps in healthcare and in global health. There are what's called knowledge gaps. There's gaps in funding, policy gaps. Some even speak about an ethical gap. But there's this well-known gap a lot of people point to called the no-do gap, which is why we don't implement best practices even after good evidence shows that they should work. So, for example, surgeons took forever to practice sterile technique, in other words, to wash their hands, even after people understood that it would improve outcomes. What are the hand-washing equivalents of community health? Who's practicing them? Do we know about them? And what are the gaps to implementing them? So we know that there are things that look like best practices in studies. And we also know that when they're implemented in other contexts, certain variables such as the population differences, the politics complexity, the resource variability, all of these elements come into play and can thwart the best intentions. Having said that, some practitioners, despite great complexity, do excel in the practice of implementation. So it's a little bit, again, going back to that clinician analogy, they're like the best doctors in a doctor group. All doctors go to medical school, they all learn from the same textbooks, yet some doctors are simply better at the art of practicing medicine. What can we learn from these masters of practice, and how do we learn from them? And what are the mastery elements of the practice of community health? So to explore this question, we have today Madeline Ballard. She's a community health scholar who recently corralled a group of wily community health practitioners to see what they could teach us based on their experience. And in full disclosure, I was participating in this same group. It was a great honor representing Partners in Health. And now it's a wonderful opportunity for me to sit down with Madeline and to talk a little bit about her thoughts, the sort of meta thoughts about what this report shows, does, and offers. So first things first, Madeline, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, so full disclosure as well, I used to work for Last Mile Health, one of the groups that's involved in this report in Liberia as a program manager back in the day when they were just sort of starting their remote healthcare delivery with community health workers and kind of trying to optimize the community health system in Liberia from the ground up in cooperation with the government. Then went back to school and went to the University of Oxford, did my PhD there in evaluation science. And my PhD was, again, looking at this question of how do we improve community health systems within the context of national health systems, just recognizing that there's a lot of evidence that community health delivery can be very effective, even sometimes better for some sorts of tasks than higher level or cadres with more training like nurses or doctors. But that often, you know, when we scale up those types of delivery systems to a national level, suddenly they don't move the needle on mortality and morbidity indicators that we know, you know, they should be able to affect. So there's a translation problem there somewhere, whether it's design or implementation, and that's kind of been what I looked at in my PhD, and that's a part of the impetus for now, having finished that, working with this group of practitioners to figure out what's going on.
Wonderful. So talking about these practitioners, so who partnered to do this report and why did you corral this group to do this?
Well, so we have six organizations who've partnered to do this report, six nonprofits: Last Mile Health, who works in Liberia; Hope Through Health, who works in Togo; Possible, who work in Nepal; Muso in Mali; Living Goods in Kenya and Uganda; and Partners in Health works in 10 countries across the world. And I can't take full credit for assembling this all-star team that also goes to the Sal Family Foundation, who's kind of been supporting this work and was originally the the original corraler, so to speak, but I was kind of brought on board to continue that. And it's been great because I think it really goes against the tide of what we see in so to speak, professionalized civil society, right? Hmm. Often I think in some ways we kind of replicate what goes on in the private sector. NGOs focus on growth, push their brands, you know, at almost all costs, and then often see each other as competitors rather than colleagues. And even if, you know, you're a strong believer in competition driving innovation, et cetera, fundamentally, all these groups are trying to reform public health systems. So there really is an impetus there to cooperate. And what we see here is a really incredible example of sustained cooperation and collaboration to compare these different models across 16 countries, really get into the nitty-gritty operational detail and look at where there might be commonalities and if there are sort of some key takeaways that align. And this is particularly important. Again, I mean, I did my PhD in this, and I can tell you that there's a lot of evidence, a lot of ink has been spilled around community health workers. But there are still several operational questions that are unresolved by the literature, and there's a space for practitioner expertise, for harnessing practitioner expertise, particularly when it comes to getting at that operational guidance, which is often missing from kind of high level reports or, you know, randomized trials that don't have enough detail, health system detail that would allow you to kind of figure out the black box of what's actually producing the effect. So,
well, that's fascinating, and we'll get into exactly what this report is showing us and what are some of the findings. But let's just for a moment focus on this question of cooperation, collaboration versus competition, because I think it's a fascinating question, and perhaps it's one of the things that really distinguishes this work. You know, already there's a lot of guidelines. Many, many exist. For example, a good friend, Henry Perry, who's a former discussant on this podcast, he helped to write big reports that we all have read. In fact, there's an entire guide, the MCHIP Guide to Community Health Programs, and I refer to people to that all the time. People, however, I know that they have limited time to read things. You know, most of the times, people skim. So then why another report? Why are we adding now this report to people's holiday reading list?
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, the holidays are a great time to sit down with some community health design and implementation reports, I got to say. Just vis-a-vis MCHIP, that's obviously a phenomenal report and a phenomenal resource. And if folks aren't familiar with it, it looks at everything from the history of community health worker programs to large questions like financing, governance, coordination. So I would continue to refer people, to that set of chapters, I guess. That being said, if we kind of delve into the different chapters, we can see how this work that we've put together in many ways builds on and extends what's already there in important ways. So for instance, you know, the MCHIP guide looks at community health worker recruitment and supervision. And some of the takeaways are, I'll just have in front of me here, I can read out, you know, developing appropriate recruitment policies and processes is a critical feature of an effective large-scale community health worker program. And they talk about how effective recruitment can help reduce attrition and that maybe community engagement could help recruitment work a little bit better. And likewise for supervision, they talk about how supervision is challenging, yet again considered, quote, one of the most important elements of successful programs. And it looks a little bit at the history of supervisory responsibilities and how they've changed over time. But what we can see if we look through these chapters is a lot of times there's no arbitration. You know, there's kind of a neutral overview of what's happened and what exists, but there's not that tangible, you know, what works in what context, or what have people tried and how have they tried it. And while there's a whole series of, again, really phenomenal case studies that I would suggest, that I would likewise recommend folks check out, those case studies don't go into this kind of nitty-gritty operational detail. They talk, you know, supervision is important, but what does that mean? You know, who does it? How frequently? What takes place? And how can you do it too? And I think that's where that this report kind of picks up where MCHIP left off and has features, you know, actual tools and actual step-by-step considerations on the part of implementers of how they've kind of solved various delivery challenges and the ways in which their environments have shaped those responses. And I think, so in that way, it kind of moves the conversation down the field a little bit, that now we've kind of prioritized what areas are important to get right. We've looked at some of the different options, and now we're sort of saying, great, here's how you operate, here's how you operationalize it. Here's how a bunch of groups, you know, have done this in 16 countries and found success. And so I think this is a great compliment to Henry Perry's work and the whole group behind MCHIP.
Wonderful. I mean, what I'm hearing is that there's a lot of work out there that gives a certain level of advice, but then there's also this space where people are hungry for more specific, on-the-ground, programmatic advice, and that this report starts to provide, fill some of that gap. Some of the things that you brought up are most people would agree with. You know, supervision is important, and then we'd love to know great ways that really premier organizations are utilizing supervision to improve performance. Some of the things, however, in this report can be up for debate and continue to be debated on the international scene. For example, paying community health workers, that's a topic that gets people pretty fired up on both sides. So how do you guys manage that difficult task of giving advice that was actually useful, you know, coming down and saying, yeah, we really think that you should do this and this because this is what we've seen, but also understanding that the debate is ongoing and data is still at different parts, different levels?
So I think one of the best things about this report is it was really transparent about the methods it used to come to the conclusions it did. You know, I think sometimes you pick up reports from various agencies, and they say things, but you're not sure how these conclusions were derived. And in this case, you know, we brought these implementers together. They've all had success as defined by, you know, they've done various impact evaluation studies that have found reductions in mortality and morbidity across a range of community health worker tasks, so to speak, you know, disease areas, lots of different primary care, chronic care applications that the community health workers were undertaking. And we said, let's systematically do a program comparison and look at areas of alignment and variation and where outliers exist and ask questions, again, of why these programs were designed in the way they were, what sort of forces they were reacting to or what prompted these decisions, and in what ways they work out. And I think that in all these 16 countries, these organizations are paying community health workers. You know, this wasn't something that we decided a priori, hey, we're going to be political and make a statement about paying community health workers. It was, hey, this is an area of alignment up and down these organizations across these countries, and that's interesting to note, you know? And that might ruffle feathers, but I think, again, there's a very interesting discussion in there about you know, different types of payment modalities, etc. And I think, again, the fact that you have this transparent methodology helps to contextualize where these conclusions are coming from, right? It's not a one-size-fits-all prototype. It's practitioner experience. Practitioner experience kind of by definition can never be definitive. But rather, you know, what's presented in the report is a series of tools and considerations that enable programs to meet high standards. It's not, you know, you need to pay community health workers X. It's sort of they should be paid and at about a level that, you know, allows them to survive. And you can do that in a lot of different ways. And similarly, you know, it's not that all the community health workers need to take a test. It's that, you know, they should, you know, this particular test, but it's that they should be minimally, you know, they should be accredited. They should have some sort of health knowledge and competencies that they're assessed on, and they should have to meet a minimum standard before carrying out their work. And so I think in this way, we've sort of produced, I like to liken them to infrastructure standards. When I used to work in Liberia, the government of Liberia undertook this process of creating infrastructure standards for clinics. And they didn't say, you know, here's the floor plan of what every clinic in Liberia should look like. Rather, they said things like, you know, it has to fulfill these functions, and you know, have good drainage, etc. So it wasn't you need to build it on a hill. It's just that you need to have good drainage, and there's lots of different ways to accomplish that. So anyway, I think this report strikes a good balance of saying something that people might, you know, might disagree with, but it's clear how those conclusions were reached, and it's clear in which contexts they were reached. And it's also humble in the sense that it knows it's coming from a place of practitioner experience, and it knows that there are probably a couple different ways to get at these broad design principles that we've been trying to isolate.
Wonderful. So this question of practitioner experience, infrastructure standards, there's in this checklist, there's a lot of text, but there's also a couple of very nice tables which people can download and see for themselves because it's widely available. So let's say someone downloads it and they're enticed by what we're saying here. How can they use it? What are they going to do with the report?
Yes, I think already it's been interesting. This report has been out since the 12th Universal Healthcare Day, 12th of December 2017. And we put it out on a website, and we had a place in the website for folks to download it, but also to kind of provide comments as they've been reading it. And I think just those comments illustrate that already it's being used in the ways that it was envisioned. Number one, for direct implementation, right? Like there are, for each of these areas that we're discussing, recruitment, supervision, training, incentivization, supply chain, etc. You know, we're looking across the different organizations across these 16 countries. We're providing different case examples of organizations that that maybe have the most refined system for doing that particular task or part of the value chain, so to speak. And then, you know, their actual monitoring evaluation documents, so their actual criteria or interview forms or questions, interview reading tests, etc. All of these tools are also online as appendices. So I think right away there's a toolbox that, you know, folks are in different contexts are struggling with this question of, you know, we really want to have a responsive supervision system, but we're not quite sure what components should be in it. You know, there's a real practical step-by-step example there. And this is not to say that it can be replicated throughout, but it's to say that this is the level of operational specificity that I think folks are craving when they're actually trying to solve issues on the ground. So number one, direct implementation. But then number two, advocacy. As I mentioned, you know, all of these organizations are working directly with ministries of health and at different stages across different countries in terms of either implementing or reforming or improving human health delivery systems in the context of national health systems, and being able to kind of walk in and say, you know, here's some hard knowledge on what we would suggest as we're making these decisions. You know, let's say as a country's writing its national community health program, Liberia just did this, and other countries several other countries are following suit. Malawi also just published theirs, and they're moving to this implementation phase. You know, what are some of the pitfalls, or what should these forms look like, or when we're making decisions on distribution of community health workers across a geographical space, you know, what considerations should be on the table? It's a really helpful tool for those conversations as well. And then I think the third thing is it's a invitation, and it asks folks to come kind of join, just realizing again with humility that it's only six organizations, and granted they work in 16 countries and they've achieved in conjunction with government partners some success in really bringing accessible high quality healthcare in some very difficult geographic or economic contexts, but that there's obviously a lot more insight out there. And so it would be great if folks could hop on board the collaboration train, so to speak, and make this even bigger than it is, and bring new insights and continue that kind of transparent, detailed sharing.
And so then for the people that might be interested in joining the conversation, what kind of people would be most useful in that conversation? And let me say it this way. Practitioner expertise, I liken it a lot to what a clinician will be experiencing on the front lines. You have these institutional guidelines, then you have what your colleagues tell you. You know, you pull someone aside and say, hey, listen, I have this kid, he's got this issue, and I'm thinking about doing this, this, and this. And that's, of course, you need that art of practice because a lot of things are going to be variable. You know, these multivariate systems, many pieces are sort of flapping in the wind, and it's the art of practice to tie them down and bring something coherent. But there's also this question of scale. A lot of the organizations that participated in this may have great impact and presence in their individual countries, but none of them are a national program, or may have contributed to national programs, but they themselves don't run national programs. National programs are funded very differently than what an NGO will fund a program with. Usually it's internal revenue and donor revenue. If there are people here listening, and you have obviously the NGOs that look up to a lot of these NGOs and say, I would love to sit down with amazing groups like MUSO, Hope Through Health, Partners in Health, to talk to them and others. But then what about the government folks that are listening and saying, well, this sounds nice, you know, they're doing their thing, but we're dealing about, you know, the country of Egypt, right? How do we translate these learnings into that context?
Well, I think that's precisely what's intended, right? Like, what we know, and I'll just draw from my own experience here working in Liberia, is that governments, they don't have the luxury of risk-taking often. You know, they're providing services for, in many cases, you know, millions of people, setting up these systems. Because they're so large, you kind of want to get it right the first time. And I think that's where these smaller groups who are kind of doing maybe direct service delivery in a small portion of a particular country, they're much smaller, which is in some cases a disadvantage, as you mentioned. But in other cases, it's an advantage because it allows for them to do that kind of experimentation and optimization and try different systems or fiddle with things. Their systems, small as they are just a lot more responsive than having to go kind of change how things are done across, you know, 27 counties or something. So they're kind of great, in the best of cases, they're great labs for figuring out, great, like, how do we solve this issue of accreditation or recruitment or training or payment or whatever? And then kind of coming up with something that works, and then, you know, going back to the government and saying, hey, like, we've built on this system that you have, tried this new approach, and we think it's something that can be incorporated into the national health system. And that's kind of what happened in Liberia, right? There was an existing community health worker program or community health volunteer program, and Lasma Health was kind of sent to the most remote parts of the country, Konobo, and told, great, fine, you want to optimize health systems, like, start here. They tried a bunch of different stuff, and I think the fact that they were able to succeed in these harsh contexts, really inspired the government to action. And so when they were then, you know, rehabbing or writing their next community health strategy for the coming decade, they drew a lot from that lab, so to speak. And so I think this is a great way for, you know, civil society organizations and government to work together and inform each other.
And it sounds like this report is a beautiful beginning and end report, but it's really the start of a conversation. And that conversation right now has been between these organizations, but really you're encouraging a much broader conversation amongst many different stakeholders. And then that will probably open up opportunities to have more transparent conversations about questions of scale and what works in which context. And I think the beautiful thing about it is that you probably now have these conversations, which probably happen anyway in a lot of, you know, behind the scenes, but now it's coming more into the forefront, saying, let's get all of us to discuss this, think about the trade-offs, talk about best practices, not, you know, let certain sort of easy tag terms trump or thwart ambition, things like sustainability or feasibility, but then saying, well, you know, if this is really just best practices, if this is the lifeblood of what makes a program run well, and we've seen this on small or moderate scale, you have to think about getting this to a large scale. And then the question is how? And we can have that conversation. That's another probably practitioner expertise question of how then do you translate what works into what's working for everybody? So with that in mind, what are the next steps? People download this report, they're going to take a look at it, they want to join the conversations, they're fired up. What do you envision being the future of this wonderful adventure that you've started?
Absolutely, and that's something that we address directly in the report. I think, and even with shout out to Artie Shaw, who designed some lovely infographics for us, both that summarize the eight key takeaways from the report, or design principles, so to speak, that were distilled from this exercise, but also a second one that kind of summarizes the next steps. And number one, as I said, we'd love to invite practitioners to continue to pool practitioner expertise to kind of create a widely employed set of design principles, and to promote the adoption of those principles in policy and practice. I think the more that we can reach, you know, theoretical saturation, so to speak, across a bunch of different contexts, the stronger these will be. I mean, right now it's, like I said, just these six organizations endorsed by several others, I'll add, but that went through this process. But I think we all know, in order for it to be, you know, more visible, more authoritative, more useful, etc., the broader the better. I think to the community health community more broadly, number two, you know, we're hoping that these types of, this conversation where we're getting more into the operational nitty-gritty will allow us to maybe start to think about some key performance indicators that constitute kind of best practice delivery for community health across different contexts, and starting to measure some of these things, or look at, you know, what proportion of community health workers are accredited. I think, as we know, data for community health systems is quite poor. I mean, we don't even have an estimate of how many community health workers there are in the world, and those that exist are missing, you know, missing multiple countries or outdated, or it's not clear who uploaded the data, etc. So I think just that recognition that on these operational questions we need to do a lot better there, and that's kind of something that the community more broadly can help kickstart. Likewise to funders, you know, I think we encourage them to look, you know, obviously for the folks are probably aware that the WHO is currently in the process of putting together some guidelines on community health systems. And I think, you know, in addition to employing those, we encourage funders to think about the design principles presented here. And we always use the metaphor of a bike. You know, if you're going and shopping for a secondhand bike, you know, all bikes kind of look the same until you know kind of the five things to look for, to test out. And I think that, again, getting a lot more specific around what does quality delivery look like in these health systems from a design perspective, again, before we do the five-year RCT, but, you know, do we have these supervision systems in place, and again, good recruitment systems in place, et cetera, could be very helpful. And then finally, researchers as well. We're hoping to kind of continue to refine existing theories of community health worker performance via operational research on key elements of community health worker-led delivery, health delivery. And I think there are some good hypotheses kind of generated in this report that we would love to see tested, and in some cases some of them are already being tested, and we think that's great.
Wonderful. So now I think you got people pretty fired up. They want to learn more. Where can they download the report?
Yeah, very simple. Just head on over to www.chwimpact.org, and the information's all there.
Great. And I know that people are furiously downloading the report already, and I'm sure more will soon. I'm sure the report...
Yes, 6 countries already. It's the response has been great.
It's really exciting. And I think that's what's most exciting is that this is the start of a much broader and larger conversation that I think your voice is going to be prominent along with these other organizations and multiple others. Any final words?
Just that we're looking forward to continuing the conversation and again moving it down the field from these things are good and these things are important to hey, how do we actually do them and what are some of the best ways of doing them so that we can better support our community health worker colleagues to do the great work that we know they can do and help make healthcare more accessible, more affordable for everybody.
And more effective, for sure. Well, fantastic. Thank you so much, Madeline Ballard. Thank you, everyone, for joining us on this very quick roundtable blast so that we could get word out about this incredible report that was just put out. And thank you very much.